Welcome to the GamesNet Berlin Europe podcast. Here, we speak with extraordinary games industry professionals and listen to their story to learn all about what they've built and who they are. GamesNet Berlin Europe is the international games industry initiative of MediaNet Berlin Brandenburg, the networking association for the media, creative and digital industries in Germany's capital region. My name is Simon Oler, and I will be your host for this program. Today, I'm speaking with Rami Ismail. Rami is a Dutch-Egyptian indie game developer and ambassador. He's the co-founder of Flambeer, the studio with which he developed games like Nuclear Throne and Ridiculous Fishing. He also developed PressKit, a free online tool for indie developers to market their games to the press. He's a seasoned conference speaker and received the 2018 Game Developers' Choice Ambassador Award for his fostering work in international regions where game developers face more resistance. Rami is also a host of the podcast The Habibis. In part one, that's what you're listening to right now, we speak about Rami's career, his beginning as a games developer and how he started out as a modder in games like StarCraft. How he went to school for games development but dropped out due to ownership issues. How he founded, built, and shut down Flambeer across a 10-year period, and why that was foretold and what it has to do with his co-founder. And also what receiving the award at GDC meant for him and his career. Make sure you subscribe to this podcast to also find part two of this episode. In part two, we go over Rami's personal life, how he grew up between two cultures, how that drives him to bring more cultural sensitivity in the gaming space, and what that means for his next endeavor after Flambeer has come to an end. Please enjoy my conversation with Rami Ismail. Hello, good day, Rami, and welcome to the show.
Hi there. Yeah, glad to be here.
Very nice to have you. You are very well known as an indie game pioneer, I would say, speaker, advisor, and... Right. Wanted to get right into it and ask you how you get started as what you are known as and how you landed in this role.
Right. I mean, it's kind of a two-part, like it's kind of a two-part story, right? I wanted to be a game developer when I was growing up, and I wanted to be a game developer because when I was 6 years old or something, my dad brought home a work computer. It was a hand-me-down from an uncle, I think. And it came with MS-DOS, and I was just immediately fascinated by the device, even though I didn't really understand any of it. So after some messing around and learning enough commands, because I didn't speak English, obviously, learning enough commands, I ended up finding QBasic, and QBasic contained a tutorial game called Gorillas, and I played that a lot with my siblings, and loved it. And one day I got curious as to what all the letters on the screen were, the code I would learn later, and scrolled through it and found the menu text and replaced that with my name. And I ran the code anew. And now Gorilla showed my name. And the idea that you can change a video game, something that you enjoy, by changing letters on a computer, that idea, I think, took hold in my mind.
I love this. And it's amazing.
Never let go. Right.
Yeah.
So that's how it started. And over the next decade and a bit, or two decades almost, no, a decade and a half, I'd say. Over the next decade and a half, up until I was about 18 years old, I spend a lot of time modding. I modded StarCraft. I modded, you know, back in the days when games were usually shipped with plain text files that defined units or characters or anything. It was very easy to mod and modify things. So I started by messing around with plain text data files, then got into modding, level editing, eventually got into working on somebody else's game. As sort of support, feedback, a little bit of help here and there with actually creating stuff. And then from there, ran some of my own projects. All of them failed miserably, obviously, like way too big in scope. I made every teenager mistake you could possibly think of. Too big in scope, team unreliable team, didn't manage to lock down a design or an interesting core mechanic. did some...
How old were you then when you made these mistakes?
Probably 16, 17 years old.
Okay, okay.
But at that part where I was switching to actual game development, I would say, like in the point where I was switching from modding stuff to making stuff, not to say that modding isn't making, but there's kind of a difference between having a foundation and having nothing, right?
Yeah, it's not zero to one, right?
Right. Like modding is wonderful because it's sort of a expression of how can we use slash misuse the available tools to create something interesting and wonderful and special and curious. And the act of game development is similar, but it starts from a different point and it ends at a different place, right?
Yeah.
So
can I ask you one question about modding?
Yeah, for sure.
You had me my ears open at StarCraft, because I really like StarCraft, and I was wondering what you modded there in StarCraft.
Oh, I did a lot of stuff. I mean, I did the basics, right? Like unit replacement, creating units, and I did a lot of map editing. The map editing was probably my favorite part because the map editor that came with StarCraft was so incredibly powerful. I even made years ago, and this makes me laugh every time I think about it, I made a map where you control a single hero unit with abilities that, you know, spawn units or things, with three lanes that go top, middle, and bottom, even though I didn't call it that way. And you could evolve your character by defeating enemies, and every side had sort of a king character. So when I saw Dota and the MOBA sort of surge, I thought, well, you know, I was at the wrong time at the wrong place. Mine was definitely not as good as those games ended up being, but the overall concept of MOBAs was definitely sort of in design space for a very long time already. I was definitely not the only person that made maps like that.
Yeah.
I saw tower defense as a fun exercise. Those were really fun to make, or sunken defense. These big maps where multiple players tried to defend sort of a central location. Yeah. I had a lot of time. I made my own campaign. It was fun. It was really fun.
Would you say that StarCraft was like, as a developer, a foundational thing for you?
Yeah, I think StarCraft was. I mean, the games that I remember most, messing around with most, were Urban Assault, which was this 1995 Windows game by Terra Tools, I think, in Germany. And it was this weird mix of a real-time strategy game and an action game. You would built units, and then you could control those units in first person. And I thought it was the coolest thing, but all their data was plain text. So modifying that, making vehicles go like six times as fast, trying to figure out how the data structures work, that was probably the game that gave me most insight into how a game was structured, right? The idea of assets being separate from data, being separate from sort of the structures that read them. That was the game that sort of taught me that. And then StarCraft probably taught me about, you know, the sort of design that goes into making a level. Because up until that point, you just go like, oh, you put some bricks in a Mario level, and then it's a Mario level. And StarCraft really forced me to think about action, reaction, trigger, response, how players move, what players do, what players know, what they don't know, how to make that fun and interesting. So, yeah, I would say StarCraft was pretty big for awesome. Me. Yeah, I love that game.
Yeah, me too, man. It was very foundational for me too, but in other ways, more like economics and like understanding strategy and stuff. So,
right.
And it was StarCraft 2 for me, but and competitive too. All that was like
nice.
So. I'm glad for the that we can nerd out over that. back to the story. You're 16, 17. You said you're making all these mistakes.
Right.
What's happening? What's going on?
So yeah, I'm making all these mistakes, and basically I'm learning what not to do, right? Which it didn't feel that great back at that time, I remember. I was feeling pretty down about my ability to actually create stuff. But every now and then I would release something that I was happy with. I wasn't proud of it, but it was at least, you know, it felt like an achievement to get it out there. And I was working along on these games by another developer that I enjoyed working on as sort of like a side gig, I guess. And yeah, eventually I kind of was presented with the choice, right? I was done with high school and I had to figure out where to go study. And in my research, I found that there were schools that actually taught game design, which was honestly shocking to me. I thought it was more of a dream that an actual career somebody could have. And I will say I was probably also pretty demotivated that I had never come across anybody that was named like me, right? It was all cool English names, but definitely not a Rami Ismail in there anywhere. So it just never came up, right? My dad, being Egyptian, always taught me that I was going to be a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer. The Egyptian word, Besmohandas, which is sort of like a high-ranking engineer. That was sort of my nickname growing up, right? Besmohandas Rami. So for me, the idea of game development as a career was shocking. But I enrolled anyway. Ended up, some paperwork went wrong. I ended up being a computer salesman for a few years as the paperwork got fixed. And then after a year of being only a full-time computer salesman and doing some game development at night, I enrolled at the Utrecht School of Art and Technology in Hilversum, the Netherlands. And I loved it. It was great. The whole, suddenly you're in a culture of people that are like you, that love video games, that have been tinkering with video games, that, have a history with games, that talk about games the same way you do, that think about games the same way that you do. And it was, as a kid who grew up between two cultures, between the Dutch and Egyptian identity, I was too Dutch to be Egyptian, too Egyptian to be Dutch. It was probably the first time I felt home.
Amazing. Right. Finding your tribe, a beautiful moment.
Right. It was big for me. It was a big moment, and it was something I cherish to this day that I went to that school and got to know all these people.
For sure. And how did Flambeer come about? Was that at this time or was that later?
It was about this time. So the first year of that university was great. I loved it. I learned so much, and I was put into a lot of disciplines. I had to do a lot of things that I was just not good at, right? I'm not a great drawer. I know my Photoshop. I know my way around making basic art. I'm not a good artist. I'm not a good musician. I can tell you when something sounds right to me or when it sounds wrong, and I can kind of discuss it in terms that make sense to actual composers or audio designers, but I can't compose something for the life of me, right? But school forced me to engage with all of those things in a very serious manner and forced me to sort of think about these disciplines as full disciplines instead of as assets or resources, right? To me, that was huge and I loved it. But then the second year came around, and in the second year, a problem occurred because the school switched curriculum in the transition between my first and second year, which meant that the second year was actually relatively undefined. I don't think the school really knew what they were doing. And we ended up just getting taught a lot of the same things that we had already learned in the first year. And for somebody who'd been making games since, we was six, I was already disagreeing with a lot of the classes and the teachings of the school because I'm a stubborn kid and sorry to all my teachers. But I ended up just being bored, right? I was bored throughout the entire second year. So at some point I set up a project and I said, I'm going to find the best students in the school and I'm going to make a commercial game. And at this point, Xbox Live Arcade was sort of the big thing in game development. So I said, okay, I'm going to make an Xbox game. So I got the best students together and I ended up with a team that was just genuinely way too big, right? This project was doomed to fail from the start. At the same time, it sort of showed that I had the capacity to bring together people around a common cause. And we started working on this game, created a management structure, made progress and actually got to the point where we got to pitch it to Xbox Live Arcade, and they were interested in talking about it. And that was the point where the school stepped in and said that anything that was created at school or using school hardware was the school's property. And they shut down the project. And the reason they shut down the project was that I picked all the best students to work on it, right? Everybody that they had hopes for the external projects that they do in the internship years and in the fourth years, ended up wanting to work on this project instead. And they could not lose all that talent to this project. So they shut it down, which I had promised the team that we were going to, that I would do whatever it took, whatever I could meaningfully do to get the game done. And now I couldn't. So I decided to quit school.
Yeah, I mean, way to pick a fight with your school, maybe unintendedly, but damn, dude.
Yeah, it was not my intent. And I wish the school nothing ill, right? I've worked with them since, and the people that were in the way back then are gone now, and the people that were supportive back then have actually evolved this sort of situation into part of the curriculum that people can follow if they're like particularly entrepreneurial or they want to go independent. Yeah. They can actually start doing that earlier in their school career, which is awesome.
Yeah, it seems like something you might want to support as a school, right?
Right. Yeah, back then that was just not an idea. We're talking about 2010, right? Independent development was young. I mean, yeah, we had Fez and, you know, that was upcoming, and Braid existed and Super Meat Boy was there. But beyond that, the indies that were inspiring were Pixel with Cave Story or Nikujin or Warning Forever, or those were the games people were talking about. And the indie scene was 20 to 30 people. Mm-hmm. You know, like you had Cactus making weird games. You had Terry Cavanaugh. You had like the old crew of independent gaming was very small. So there wasn't much of a career and there wasn't much of an industry structure around it. There was no press that cared about indie games. There was no independent games programs. You had Xbox Live Indie Games, XBLIG. But that was basically tiny throwaway experiments, right? It was more game jam games than commercial products most of the time. So indie just kind of didn't exist. So yeah, school didn't support it.
Exactly. So you quit?
In the second year, the project got shut down. And one of the designers on the team was this kid that I absolutely just, the strongest dislike I could put into words, right? But he was good. I had met him about a year and a half earlier, and our first meeting was not great. We already didn't like each other straight away. He thought I was too business focused. I thought he was a hipster that just didn't care about actually, you know, doing this seriously. But he had convinced me he was a great designer with a prototype of his that he showed me a few months earlier. So when I was putting together this team, I got him on board, right? His name was Jan-Willem Nijman. And when I dropped out of school, he was the only other person who was dropping out. And it was not because of me. It was not because of the project. He didn't care too much about the project. He just had fun trying to figure out if this was something interesting. And I realized that I'm really good at, you know, putting things together, bringing a game from all the things I'd made, from the sort of bigger games that I'd worked on as that sidekick on those earlier games. I'd learned to work with teams. I'd learned to how to communicate with Xbox Live Arcade. I learned to communicate about money. And I knew how to finish a game. I was a programmer, right? Over the decades, I'd become a good programmer. Now, Jan-Willem, he was an incredible designer, right? Even at that age, even when he was 20, and he wasn't even 20, he was 19, I think. He was an incredible designer, just in a sense of feedback, a sense of responsiveness, a feeling to his games that is, you know, not something you come across very often in designers. Mm. And he's really good at starting things, but everything he released was a prototype that got thrown away after 2 days and then released with the idea of, I'll just put it out there, right? So he realized he couldn't finish things, and I realized I couldn't start things. And we both were suddenly out of a school, and without much of a path in life. So we decided that he had this little prototype called Crates from Hell. And we decided that we would release it on Xbox Live Arcade. So we started working on that. We called the company Vlambeer. And we got started on trying to do that. And then as we were going, we realized that Super Crate Box was not going to be large enough for Xbox Live Arcade, that we didn't have enough of a fan base to release a commercial game. So we pivoted to making Super Crate Box our business card and made a flash game called Radical Fishing to make some money. And that's really where things started. The idea was to make one or two games and then have enough money to continue with our life. Right, not have to work together ever again. And instead, we lasted as a company for exactly a decade.
Wow. And of course, you made Nuclear Throne.
Right.
I guess your most well-known title. Can we talk a little bit about indie games? You mentioned it before that you started at a time where there wasn't really a space for that. I guess I kind of know, but I want to hear it from you. What's the state of indie games now? It seems like they're a good bit more important, and it seems like you played a part in that, right?
I mean, I don't know. Like, I was at the right place at the right time, I think. But what I will say is that independent development has obviously become sort of the foundational structure of games over the past decade, that it has gone from sort of a fringe that enthusiasts would check to probably the games that people play most over time. There's a lot of really high quality indie games, and we don't even separate. You know, in most award ceremonies, we don't really have an indie award anymore because indie games just stand toe-to-toe with these huge AAA productions, right? I think what happened over the past decade is extremely interesting in that you had a medium, you had this B sort of, what do you call it, like B games? Yeah, you had triple A games, B games, and then you had experimental indie stuff, right? That was where it started.
Right.
Indie got more serious, it got more commercial, it got ways in to commercialize, right? Whether it was Flash, and then after Flash, it was iOS and Steam, and then it kind of grew everywhere. As those developments happened, the B games kind of got pushed out of existence because making games on a budget just didn't work anymore because you couldn't compete with the AAAs and you couldn't compete with the indies, not with the AAAs because of quality, not with the indies because of budget. So the B games industry just kind of disappeared and indie took over.
Do you have some examples for like B games? I'm just trying to think what B games are.
B games were like these wonderful, I always thought of them as wonderful, but they were sort of like the discount version of big games, right? You would have these racing games, right? Big racing games. And then you would have the discount version of it. I don't remember what it was. Battle racing instead of Destruction Derby.
Yeah.
And you had, instead of Wipeout, you had Killer Loop. Stuff like that, where it was clear that the games were trying to emulate something that was a AAA game, but just trying to do it on a budget.
Yeah. Okay, I get it. I have the picture now. It's like games you get for a tenner in the supermarket, but
right
on the weird
pyramid. Yeah, they were always in that weird box in the corner of the store.
Yeah,
or that, always
in
like
green
right
thing.
Yeah. 70 discs thrown in a box, and you just kind of rummage through and go like, ah, oh, this looks cool.
Yeah,
and then you would buy it for like 9 guilders back in the day and go home. And it was, you know, not the greatest game you'd ever played, but it was really good entertainment usually.
Yeah.
So indie kind of pushed that out, and that left a pretty big vacuum for people who wanted to play games that weren't that expensive or even were a little different. Indie started as a counterculture, I think, or at least the generation of indie I'm part of started as counterculture. It was a lot of games being too big on presenting narrative set pieces instead of gameplay, right? A lot of the early indie was games should be more interesting than trying to emulate movies. So over the years, it commercialized. I think I had a little part in that. Back in those days, Flamber was one of the indies that was really serious about doing business and negotiating deals and earning money. And I remember back in those days, wanting to have a Rami on your team was like, that was just a thing people said. Like, I wish I had a Rami on my team.
Oh, that's nice.
It was cute. It was also a little scary. But yeah, no, the idea of somebody who would handle business and marketing on top of being a programmer, that was really appealing to a lot of indies. But a lot of indies just ended up being good at it themselves. And there were always the people that were kind of a bit of both. You had Alexander Bruce working Antichamber. You had Brian working on releasing games on like 30 SKUs. Yeah, you know, everybody was kind of doing their own thing. And there were a few people that were serious about the business and there were a few people that were not. So as things grew, Flamber always ended up being in that weird spot where we were one of the more commercially successful studios that was also rapidly releasing games, right? We released Super Crate Box. Right after that, we were on Serious Sam the Random Encounter with Devolver Digital, one of their first published games. We were in their initial indie reach out. Flamber was one of them. We connected Devolver with Hotline Miami, which ended up being sort of one of the defining hits for Devolver that they then used to catapult themselves to, you know, incredible heights. Just a very impressive story. We ended up being one of the first Apple Indie Games that got an Apple Design Award and Apple Game of the Year, together with Greg Woolwind, who was one of the people who had, I think, already gotten one before for Solipsgear, and Zach Gage, who was working on strange, interesting little games, but on iOS, mostly BitPilot, stood out for us. And we worked with Eirik Surko. I shouldn't forget to mention Eirik Surko, who now is probably best known for the Spelunky soundtrack, but did incredible music work on Ridiculous Fishing as well. So we were there. Then Luftrausers, we were early. We helped sort of figure out what indie on PlayStation looked like with the help of Shahid Kamal, who was really pushing and pioneering indie at PlayStation. Signed our deal on the back of a coaster for a cup at a bar or a pub, or we were having food somewhere. I think both of us don't drink, so it was, you know, not drinking that way, but just like a tea or something. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, from there, Twitch started becoming a thing. Flamber was one of the first on Twitch. We were the first studio ever, I think, to sell our game on Twitch, because I hacked. Well, hack is a big word, but I, you know, like hack as in duct taped together. I duct taped together the Twitch API with a Steam code release. So anybody who would subscribe to our channel would get a Steam code. So every time things were happening, for me, part of the business of Flamber was always to have an interesting business case, right? So we were not just experimental in our game design. We were experimental in how we tried to sell our games, how we tried to promote our games. And we live streamed on Twitch our development for 3.5 years, every Tuesday, every Thursday, while selling our game on Twitch. Just deciding that it would be a good idea, you know, to sell the game where people were following news about the game. Which ended up defining a lot of that culture as well. So, I don't know. Yeah, like,
certainly unique. That was something that I worked at Twitch for 4 years, and I think your channel always had a unique price on subs. You had like $7.99 or something, and then you would get the game with the sub, and these are things that were totally unheard of for developers. And I'm not even sure to what degree that exists today, but that was so ahead of its time.
That
it was just looking at the channel was like, what, like $7.99 or whatever it was like, always stood out. It was good to see.
So yeah, it's not that, you know. And then in the meanwhile, there were things like I created press kit because I got bored of making press kits, and that ended up being the de facto standard for press kits in the entire games industry. By accident, I didn't mean to do that. I actually made it for myself, and then Phil Tabatowski at Young Horses, who you might know from Octodad and Bugsnacks, was one of the people I was asking feedback from, including, you know, there were people in the press that I was asking feedback from. But Phil said, can we use this as well? And I cleaned up the code and just went, oh, I'll release it for public. And then it became the standard. And I started traveling. I started doing this public speaking thing by accident. And it started as a necessity. I was in the Netherlands and the Dutch Games Press reaches 15 million people. I love all of them, but yeah, that's not enough people to sell games. So I had to go to London. And the only way to get there with no money as school dropouts was to do public speaking. That was the only way I could think of that anybody would pay for me to go to London, is if I could give a talk or a presentation. So I started doing the public speaking thing. My talks ended up being very successful. I think I hit sort of a balance between business-mindedness and creativity that was useful. And it meant that that before long, I was traveling all around the world to give speeches, right? I ended up in San Francisco because of IGF Award. Jan Willem and I went there for Super Crate Box. And I started speaking more and more. And at some point, I started getting all these invitations from places that I hadn't even considered that there was game development there, right? Like getting invitations from South America and North Africa and Asia of just like, I saw your talk on YouTube. Could you come speak to our developers here? And I was just like, can you afford to fly me there? And they would always go like, no, we're like four people. We don't have money. And I was like, I don't have money either. So if you ever have money, let me know. And sometimes there'd be a university that could pay for it. But most of the times I'd have to say no. So when Ridiculous right. Fishing came out and Flyby suddenly made, you know, frankly, absurd amount of money. I asked John Willem if I could spend some of that on going to all of those places and talking to all of those developers. And that's what kind of kicked off my travel career, I guess, where I just went around the world. And every time I would go somewhere, I would learn unique solutions to particular problems. And I would be able to relay unique solutions that I'd seen somewhere else for problems people were having. And as it went, that network became bigger and bigger until I was probably, I don't know, like, I don't, who would be the most, would I be the most internationally connected developer in the world? I have no idea, but I must have been close, right? Mm. In terms of personal connections.
Yeah,
so
point stands, yeah.
I just tried to help, and I kept trying to help for as long as I, you know, for as long as I could. And now with COVID, I've shifted it to digital a bit, but that's kind of how I ended up being who I was, right? There was just, I was reaching a lot of people. And because of that, I think a lot of companies that were looking at figuring out their indie strategy or figuring out their procedures or their deals for independent developers ended up talking to me because I was talking to a lot of them. But I also understood the business and the realities of the industry. So I was just the right person at the right place at the right time. I don't think I did anything particularly special there. I do think that me being raised Dutch Egyptian really helped in my decision to focus on these emerging territories, to focus on these places that I felt were just underrepresented entirely in games.
For sure. And I would suggest we talk about that more in part two. I think you tied up the story very beautifully. And I think it's very inspiring to see. You kind of said, yeah, nothing special. And I totally get that. I think it's just what we see a lot with this kind of, let's say, talent or ability stack, where just if you're just a developer, that's one thing. But if you're a business-minded developer, okay, now you've got something. If you're a business-minded developer who can tell a story, now you've got more. And if you are also, like you said, and we will get more into that in our second half, who is particularly interested in mainstream territories. Now we've got four things stacked upon each other that make a very unique mix. And I guess that would be my kind of mirror back to you, my explanation for, that clearly must lead to something, right? That would be, well, thank you for that story first and foremost. And Would you agree with my assessment? I don't want to just put it there as an absolute.
I think so. I think there, I think the thing with being a developer is being only a developer will never be good, right? Like, you have to be a developer with an interest. And whether that is being business-minded or liking art or being into literature or whatever it is, whatever the additional is, I think just being one thing in any creative field will lead to stagnation. And it's a fine place to start. I was a programmer at the start with minimal extra interests, but as you grow, you have to evolve other interests, and I think business is one of them. But again, like Jan Willem, my former co-founder of Lambeer, he's a game designer, and he has he was pretty single focus when we met at being a game designer, and he's grown his influences tremendously over the decade. But that is also fair. I think as long as you don't, what I'm trying to say is the most boring games, in my opinion, get made by people who only take inspiration from games, right? And
gotcha.
Finding a balance between the game design part of games and the inspiration / influences part of games, I think that's what makes beautiful things.
No doubt about it. I would like to ask you for the end of this segment a couple of quick fire questions.
Yes, let's go.
See what comes to mind. First one, obligatorily important. What games are you playing right now, or what games are on your watch list, or what has impressed you in recent times? Open question, what games have entered the brain of Rami recently?
Right. I've been playing Flight Simulator a lot, like an absolutely ridiculous amount. I fly long-haul flights, intercontinental. I do proper like briefings and everything. It's gotten out of hand tremendously. I've been so impressed by the fact that all of Earth in a recognizable way is in a video game, and it's a completely new way of thinking of what we can do with games, right? With the cloud, with streaming technology, with stuff like that. I continue to play Destiny. I don't think I will ever tire of that game. I just finished the new raid in that game, the 6-player end game activity, and it's such a tour de force by the Bungie team. Like, highlight after highlight, beautiful, evocative moments, challenging, puzzling scenarios, very tight gunplay, as you'd expect from Bungie. I've been playing Post Void again, which is this little indie FPS that I will have to warn everybody who wants to check it out that, strongly flashing graphics. But this beautiful condensed version of a FPS that, might remind people of Devil Daggers, another minimalist first-person shooter. I'm trying to get better at that. I'm honestly, quite frankly, terrible at it. And then I picked up Hitman, and Hitman has been just incredibly impressive. I finished the Dubai level and the opening level and the level after that. And the versatility of IO Interactive just never ceases to amaze me.
Fantastic. Next question right away. What's your favorite event, long in the past now? maybe there's something current for business / for hanging out, and what do you have, maybe a little story about something?
I mean, I think at this point, my favorite, like, there's always been a lot of interesting events, and I think, depending on what you want out of your business, there's different events that are interesting, right? If I want to just hang out, figure out what is happening in the industry, learn what people are talking about, if I want to do that at sort of the corporate end of the industry, I would go to a DICE in Vegas. If I want to figure it out sort of across the industry, including indies, I might go to a Reboot. If I want to figure out what's happening in Europe, there's the events during Berlin Games Week. If I want to figure it out in Australia, just GCAP. Like, the industry has gotten so big that depending on what your goals are and where you're looking, there's a good event for any place. So it's hard to say what my favorite event is. I've always appreciated the sort of chillness of Reboot. So maybe Reboot Develop. I don't know. It's hard to pick.
Understandable. It's I'm just thinking about the question. Maybe asking for the for a favorite isn't fair.
It's hard with so many events that are good for so many different reasons.
For sure. This is, of course, the GamesNet Berlin Europe podcast. And again, asking for a favorite, but what is your favorite memory connected to Berlin?
I mean, that must probably, probably Amaze. There was in 2011, there was the Big Jam. It was the Berlin Independent Games Jam, I guess. It was in a little cafe on, Karlsplatz? Is that a thing?
That's possible.
Yeah, a tiny cafe there. It was one of my first international trips, right? I'd been to Cologne for Gamescom because that was my first ever event. And then I had gone to San Francisco for GDC. I'd been to London for that talk. And then I just went to a jam in Berlin, and it just sounded like such a ridiculous idea, right? To get in a train for 6 hours to a foreign country to make video games for 2 days. I thought I was out of my mind, and I had the best time I can possibly imagine. Met a lot of great people. A lot of people that I'm still friends with or close friends with to this day. And it was just, it was the first time I felt part of that international sphere, because you have to remember Jan Willem in Vlaanderen was the indie. I was the business guy. I was the suit. So getting to feel part of the community on my own terms was really, really nice. And I think Big Jam was a big part of that. So probably that.
That's awesome. And I'm sure the people who were there and remember that will have a fond memory as well. Rami, thank you very much for your insights. Time is flying. And we will hear each other again in part two of this conversation.
Very much looking forward to it.
Where we speak more about your influences as a person, how you grew up, and all that. So let's stay tuned for that. Thanks for listening to part one of this episode. Be sure to also check out part two, which will be released 2 weeks after part one on all podcast platforms. So it might already be out by the time you hear this. Whatever platform you're on, subscribe or follow the GamesNet Berlin Europe podcast to listen to many more insightful conversations with fantastic games industry guests from Berlin and from all over Europe. Thank you very much and see you very soon. Bye-bye.
Hi there. Before you go, this is Florian, project manager for GamesNet Berlin Europe. If you want to stay connected to the network, find out more about upcoming events and links to other MediaNet initiatives, you can visit us at gamesnetberlin.eu and subscribe to our newsletter. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast, and until next time.